All right, it is time. The grand finale, final session of Tech Days. Thank you guys for deciding to join in that session with us. Quick question. How many of you have to rush immediately after for a train or a boat or an airport? A good few of you. All right, we'll wrap up on time, so no worries, you'll make it. I know that some of you will leave during the session because we got some heads up, but that's how it is. Luckily, the sessions are also recorded, so yeah, you will be able to review it after. My name is Johan, this is Mr. Jürgen, and together we'll be your host for the next hour now, 60 minutes. I live in Halmstad, not too far from where Jürgen live, not on the beach, but close to it. Work with Trusec, I write books, I do consulting, trainings, sessions. I'm busy. I'll try to keep myself busy. Most of the stuff that I discover and learn during the normal consulting work for, quite frankly, that is where you pick up most fun things. Things that are supposed to work one way and suddenly they're not. So my blog is Deployment Research. Feel free to go to the Facebook page also. There's a link from there on that blog. Or send me an email if you run into something. Both me and Jürgen, we've been doing deployments for a long, long time. And as usual, we might not have seen everything, but you know, we've seen quite a bit.
And if we haven't seen it, we hopefully solve it for you. If you have any good suggestions on other things we have missed so far.
So this is...
Yeah, and my name is Jörgen Nilsson, and I work for OneWin in Malmo, actually. So I actually plan to add another icon there. I'm a Liverpool supporter, but I'm also from Malmo, and we know who won the Swedish Football League this year, so I tried to find a good logo to put in there, but I didn't, actually. So not to rub it in, but I think we also won the most so titles of all teams in Sweden as well. And I'm from Malmo. I do my blogging at ccmx.com, and I'm on Twitter as well. Just email if you want something, need something, have questions. And we'll hope we'll learn you something new today, and we'll take it from there.
Shorthand story, if you guys are not on Twitter, get on Twitter. There is no better medium, period, to get updates quickly about what's going on in this industry. Since Microsoft is picking up the cadence on basically everything they do, Windows, servers, clients, config manager, MDT stuff, they are releasing stuff really rapidly. And Twitter is just a fantastic medium to only spending like 5-10 minutes a day, you can get a good grasp about what's going on in this industry, giving you some heads up when there are issues. For example, I remember when ADK 1511 was released and people were starting to like test around and quickly realized there were some bugs in it and like, whoops, don't use this. It's quite nice to learn about stuff like that quickly, so you don't have to hit the wall, all of you, just some of you.
Yeah, Twitter is amazing, and there's a lot of good product guys as well on Twitter that tweets both high and low and historical things and coming things, so it's a really good source of information.
How many of you are using Config Manager? Like 90% in the room. Kind of makes sense. We are quite known for working with Config Manager, but for example, on Twitter, this gentleman, DJammer with 3 M's instead of 2, do you know who it is? That's the top geezer for Config Manager. He owns Config Manager. He's on Twitter posting things on a daily basis. You can actually ask him questions, and he typically will respond. And that's, I think, is a quite unique or new approach from Microsoft lately. The Config Manager team, they weren't too open about changes or influences. Now they're quite the opposite. For example, there is a Config Manager user voice, a forum where you can post ideas for Config Manager. And as of Ignite this year in October in Atlanta, there were well over 600 ideas from sysadmins around the globe, people like you. 61 of them actually made it into the current product. And that's pretty good. So they do listen, they do hear your feedback, so don't hesitate to reach out to these guys. Don't hesitate to post comments and ideas or issues you are having because they see them. And now when they have a rapid release cycle, Config Mount is coming 3-4 times every year, the stable versions, they will fix them. They will add them in. It's not like before when it's like a 5-year period between a release. They fix a lot of stuff.
Yeah, they do. And if you're not on User Voice now, just tell me and Johan, because you only get the announced specific number of votes. And if you haven't used your votes, we have some topics you can vote for.
Yes. The cool thing, though, is once the product team actually implements something, you get your votes back. So,
yeah,
nice.
That's good. That's good.
So, throughout this session, we're going to touch on a ton of common customizations that we see organizations are doing for their Windows 10 deployment projects. There are obviously more, but this is like the key ones that we see happening. And we also see companies having, I wouldn't say issues, but at least a little bit of a stumble on.
Yeah.
So, yeah, ton of them, and we'll walk you through them. Check. Start menu, never heard of.
No.
Do you want your image?
Yeah, it could be.
Sure.
Could be.
Wow. Okay, then.
Interesting. Ah, look at that. So, how many of you have played around with the start menu already in Windows 10? How many found it to be an intuitive and good experience? No, it's kind of hard to add stuff as well, right? Afterwards, you actually created one. But let's start with the basics. Why? I mean, you know that we use an XML file, right? So we have an XML file we export with all the content of a specific start menu, and then we can import the same XML file. Do you know why it's an XML file? Oh, God, it must be because it's the last session of the day.
No, everything is XML files.
Yeah, exactly. But the reason for it being an XML file is that we have this new Intune MDM management option as well. And putting an XML file through that channel is impossible. But what you can do is you can point to an XML file. So that's the same. That's the reason why we have the same for the Enterprise Site Mode list for Internet Explorer as well. Same thing. You can point to an XML file, but you can't add all that content through the OMADM agent. So that's the reason behind it, right? So if we go back, we start. And of course, this will be a specific string throughout the session as well today. We actually need Enterprise or Education Edition to do a lot of these tweaks. So Microsoft is really pushing everyone on Windows Professional to go to Enterprise. So if you, for instance, try to apply a custom start menu on a Pro Edition machine, you will get an entry in the event viewer that says, sorry, wrong, you're not licensed to use this, basically. So, and more features are moving through the Enterprise SKU as well. So the Pro SKU is for bring your own device. Enterprise is even for small and medium businesses as well today.
So you get what you pay for.
Yes,
check.
Exactly.
Making a note.
Yeah. So creating the XML file. I do the modifications I want on my start screen, of course, and then I just type export start layout, right? This is the easiest way to update it as well, as you will actually get all the necessary information to modify the file you already have deployed today. So if we just take a quick look at that file, of course. And then we have exactly the start layout that it looks in my environment here. So it's nothing, but if we want to add stuff afterwards to the XML file we use in production, if we use a group policy, for instance, which I actually think you should use and not import the default one during our deployment, what we can use is this part when we add stuff afterwards so we know which app to use, right? It's hard to find that property on the app some other way, so it's the easiest way to do it. And also we have some other stuff there as well that will break as well. So that's how we do it, and I guess some of you have done it already. We can also make sure that we only manage a part of the Windows 10 start menu starting from 15.11 and forward, and that's actually a very good option to use. I don't know how many of you uses that one instead. Because if we use group policies, if we apply a default when during OSD, it will be a static start menu, right? And the user can do what they want. And you can never remove anything as well. If we actually use this part as well instead, so we actually use the group policy option to deploy or to point to the XML file, We can actually modify the part that's controlled by the company afterwards. So we can, for instance, we can add Internet Explorer there. And when we've phased out Internet Explorer, which you know we shouldn't be using anymore because it's much more unsafe than Edge, and Edge is the future browser, we can go in and remove the Internet Explorer icon from that part. You can't do that if you don't manage it at all. So that's why we should do that from the beginning as well. So if we just look at the machine, we have the locked part of the start menu with a nice little lock on it. And we have, and here I can do whatever I like. But I can't do anything with these up here. They are locked, right? So it's a good combination of control and user being in control. So we can help them, and we can, because it's really hard to write instructions, right, if we don't know how it looks as well. So we can actually do this, so we can have some sort of control how it looks for the service desk as well. But there's a lot of, I think I made a checklist, like if you if an icon is available here and you add it to your XML file, it will be moved to the corporate part because the shortcut can only exist once on the start menu. You can't have it twice. And you should really deploy this as soon as possible. Because, and you should have that in your plan already. Because if you wake up one day and say, or management or the user says, we want the Outlook icon to be there on all machines, fix it. And you go ahead and say, I will deploy a partial locked start menu, that's no problem. The problem is that the first time you apply it, you actually wipe everything that's in there for the user. So you won't be able to do that. So you should plan that now. And even if you don't want to add anything, just do as I did, like add Edge and Internet Explorer and Outlook perhaps. So you actually add something, then you can add and remove whatever you want in the future. Because if you don't do it, you can. But I don't know, do you think you will be a popular person on IT if you remove everything in the user start menu? How many users do you think will call in and say, ask what you're doing? Or ask where the icons are and ask how they can start their applications, right? So you should plan ahead and do that from the beginning in your project as well. If we, and there's a lot of, if we unlock the group policy, the user can control that part as well. So if it falls out of management or something like that, the only thing that happens is that those locked icons are unlocked, so you can modify them. And if you have applied it once and you fall back into management scope again, they are controlled again without wiping the rest of the part as well. So you could actually get away with applying it once and then remove it and then still have the possibility to change it in the future. So there's a lot of scenarios that, of course, probably will change with Windows 10, 17, XX or whatever.
Something, yeah,
of
next
course.
Year.
So we have new challenges, right? Are there anyone, most of you use Configuration Manager, are there anyone that's using Intune here? Ah, look at that. So we can actually deploy the same XML file using Intune. We need to use a custom policy called start layout. And we need to put the XML file like on a web server so everyone can reach it. We also need to remove all the markup characters in the file because otherwise it will not work. This is the best place to do it. So if I open my file, we can take, not that one. You should take the other one, the correct one. It's better. So if I take my whole file.
Control A.
Could do that as well. But I have a Lenovo and they don't know where to place the FN button, right?
Oh yeah,
control. So it's hard to find. And if I hear it, I can say remove my characters if the web page would reply. So then it will look like this down here instead. So that's how it should look like when you deploy it through the OMA DM agent to clients managed by.
Because it's special and doesn't like normal XML files.
Exactly. And it's the same for everything we do with files through that channel, actually. And that web page is a good web page to convert that as well. So that's the good part, right?
Yes.
So that's how it looks if someone wants to have it afterwards. Another challenge, or challenge. When we deploy it using group policy, we have two options, basically. You could actually both do a partial lockdown, and you can do a full lockdown as well. If you do a full lockdown, it's perfect for like fixed workload computers, browser computers. So you actually, the user can't touch the start menu at all. You basically lock it down for them, right? But if it's a machine that's running one application, say in a hospital, you run one application of 100 users logging onto it every day, maybe that's a good idea to just have that one application there. Otherwise, the partial lockdown is for everyone else. The group policy is not that much to talk about. The partial stuff is
fun.
Here. Oh, interesting. So what differs is the only specified groups that are in the middle there. So if we add, if we add a layout customization restriction type to only specified groups, only the groups in after that will be controlled. If we remove that line, the XML file will be mandatory for all users. They can't add anything at all. So that's how we change it to only specified groups and only to do a partial lockdown. And that's how I actually recommend that you use it as well, because it's much better. How many of you have tried to add the Internet Explorer link to the start menu? Was it a good experience? No, for some reason, it's not like Internet Explorer should be used anymore. But the problem is that the Internet Explorer, when the start menu is loaded, everything that's on the start menu must be present on the machine. The Internet Explorer icon you see under accessories, it's actually created by an active setup the first time you log in, after the start menu is applied. So that's why it doesn't work.
I also think that the main reason for Internet Explorer being used is that Edge doesn't always work.
Absolutely, of course.
Could be, yeah.
But Edge works much better in 16.07. Otherwise, it would be... before 16.07, yeah, it's not that good. That's the best we can say, I think.
Very polite.
Yeah, very polite. So what we need to do if we want to add, and that's the same if we want to add a shortcut to a web page using the Edge browser, we can use just straight up in the XML file. But if we want to use it to create a shortcut to and use Internet Explorer, we must copy a .link file somewhere on the machine that we can point to, right? We'll come back to that beautiful little experience of the Internet Explorer shortcut as well. So, but if you want it on there, you need to create the icon yourself and put it somewhere, right? We will come back to why that's a bad idea as well later on, or a challenge in the future. So, let's continue with the stuff. The Windows 10 taskbar. The best thing I like is when someone say, "Wow, we can't modify the taskbar in Windows 10." Oh, yes, we can. There are some limitations to what we actually can do in dirty scripts and solutions as well. I will show you one of them later on. But that's the best thing that someone can say. I can't modify this. Yes, we can, of course. So what I did is I actually checked what roaming profiles and what the user experience, virtualization experience, what files and what register settings they roam when you roam from one machine to another. And then I just took a script that just took those files and register settings and exported them. And then you can import a dirty taskbar in Windows 10, 15.07, and 15.11. It works for 16.07 as well,
but
you shouldn't do it anymore. Because now we can use the XML file we use for the start menu as well to modify the taskbar. So that should be used instead.
It's not the perfect solution yet, but at least it's a supported one that allows you to modify stuff on the taskbar. Yeah.
And again, we can modify it afterwards as well.
Yes.
So if we add the Outlook icon and you move to Office 365 and E1 license, then they shouldn't have the Outlook icon anymore. Then we can remove it, right? So that's also good as well. So we get some kind of control over it. What we do is we add a lot of stuff to our XML file. In the end, that's actually called custom taskbar layout creation. And in there, we actually put everything. Yeah, that's much better. So there we actually put what we want there, right? Interesting settings here is this one. I don't know if anyone used it. Replace means that you actually remove the store and remove everything that's default. So if you want to remove Edge from the taskbar, you can do that. Just say replace. What I've done here is I've used replace to remove everything, and then I add the Edge back, and I add File Explorer back, and I add Internet Explorer back, which wasn't there from the beginning. So I have those three icons instead. But we also get rid of the store icon as well, which is a very popular wish as well to remove, right?
Yeah, replace is nice.
Yeah. So you should try this out if you haven't used it before, because it's very, very simple to use. User group policy. You can modify it afterwards. There's a lot of, I made a slide with everything I could find. There's probably even more lessons learned here that you can only remove shortcut once again exactly at the start menu. So I can remove something we have added at admins, but I can't remove something that Johan added because he wants it there, right? Because he owns that part of the taskbar. And same thing for the start menu. If Johan adds something and I add it, it will be moved to the manage part, and then we can remove it as well. So that's how it works, basically.
Yeah. It's a nice addition. It is.
It's a nice addition, but it's only 16.07, even if you're not using it today, you should really try it out. And once again, it requires enterprise or education SKU to work.
Yeah.
So pro is a different topic.
So the short end story, as I mentioned in the previous session and earlier this week, I would normally not recommend customers to go ahead and start off using a current branch release of Windows 10. I recommend to wait to the stable ones, but this is an exception. This one is so much better than 15.11 in my opinion. So go with the flow for now and use it. Another very common customizations I see is connecting file extensions to applications. And I mean, for example, by default, Windows 10, if you double click a PDF file, it will open in Edge, instead of maybe Adobe Reader that you installed on the box. And customers don't like that. They like to be able to change that. Even worse, when you've done upgrades from 15.07 to 15.11 to 16.07, those type of settings tend to be reset back to the normal ones. Microsoft promised they are changing that in the future. We'll see. I believe it when I see it. But that's the story. The Creators Update coming March, February next year, hopefully, is set to do that. Anyway, what you can do as admins, you can go in and configure this the way you like it, and then you can export it. So the way you will do this is you will find a Windows 10 machine. I can borrow this one here. Log in. An admin in this case. Wait patiently. Duh. Close enough. In default programs, in settings, and by the way, the shortcut is Windows I to get to settings, you also have the shows default apps by protocol. So this is where I can configure and say, right, if I open an HTTP link, it should use IE instead of Edge, and I say same thing for HTTPS and maybe for FTP as well, but you get the idea. You can go in and you can configure the stuff the way you want it to be. Then you simply use a PowerShell command to export this. So on my blog, Deployment Research, and also in the slide deck as well on this here, you will find the commands to do it. So if I search for Internet Explorer in this case, it'll take you to a blog post about configuring it as a default browser. And same view here, but this is the command you run to simply take what you have done and, again, export it into an XML file. Then, I mean, this is an online export. And if you go to the documentation in DSM and read about import and export, you're supposed to do it online as well, the actual import, which would have been very nice, except the very fact it doesn't work. at all. Yet.
Anymore. There it used to work as well.
Yeah. There is a fix, an upcoming fix we've been promised, but we'll see. Again, I believe it when I see it.
Seeing is believing, right?
Yeah, right now it doesn't work. So we have to do it either through offline or, well, possibly group policies as well. But what you can do during deployment in your sequences, in the post-install phase, where Windows is still, well, Windows is not running, it's Windows PE at this point, then you can do the import of the XML file. And this works obviously in LightTouch as well as Config Manager. This is a LightTouch sequence. So this is something you can do as well to get those policies or protocol settings in that in turn control the stuff. So this one, later, doesn't work right now, even though it's supposed to. It's one of those, whoops. Yes, Randy.
And we can also use group policies as well, right?
Yeah.
If we want to lock it down as well.
I had later so in the post, I configure a group policy and I do two things in the policy. One, I'm using a preference to simply get the file down to the client. That's the first thing, copying it down. And then I simply set that point to that file.
Yep.
And
this one has to be complete, yeah. So that's why we do the export. From a system that is, you know, the way we like it. It might be interesting if you're running different sets of apps, yes. Hopefully, since you deploy this through the sequence, you should be able to control that. Policies could be interesting, yes.
Yeah, then you will have a problem, right? Yeah. The biggest problem with that is it actually, if you apply it, you can actually go in as user and change the default association until you log on again. Then it resets itself. So it's not the best way. The best way would be that it would dimmed out, right? So the user actually understands that I can change this. But it isn't. So the user can change it, and it will change back, and then they can continue with that dance if they like.
Can you imagine?
Until they give up and call service desk.
Can you imagine how much fun?
They will
fun
lose, of course.
You can have so much fun with this.
Yeah, but the problem is that you said with Adobe Reader is a good example, and then you install the big Adobe Suite instead, and you want to associate that with PDF instead, right?
Yeah.
So that's a challenge with using the group policy, and that's a different way to use it as an import instead. So.
Yes, branding,
yes.
Mr. Jorgen?
Sure. So how many do branding of the operating system? Like changing background pictures, lock-on screens, icons, user icons, and all that. It's also a chase because that also changed for 1607, of course, with different file sizes and news resolutions. And so this will, if we go down this road, we will always have to do like catch up and play catch up for all our lives, basically. The biggest issue with this, when you do this, is that it's actually the trusted installer that owns those files. So an admin can't just copy over them. So you need first to take ownership of them, basically. I'm using a CMD command file, so Johan will hackle me for it later. But that's why I'm going to say how you should do it instead how I've done it, all right. The most beautiful way, of course, because what is trusted installer in real life, right? It's the Windows installer engine. So if you just create an MSI package with these files in it, it will run just beautiful. Because it's executed in trusted installer permissions. So that's actually the most beautiful way to do it, at least. But this is the file, these are the files for the wallpaper. There's new resolutions in Windows 10 compared to Windows 7 or Windows 8.1. So if you've done it before, you need to redo them again. And then we have the lock screen as well. If we want to change the lock screen, we can change those values as well. And we can also change the user pictures if we like that. Of course, this shouldn't be easy, right? Because the user pictures have 5 different resolutions nowadays in 1607 because we have the new start menu with with these ones here, right? The small ones there should work as well, as should the big ones when I lock my machine. So it's a game of catch up as well because it will never stay the same, and probably change again. So in this case, I have my icon down here. Let's see if I can do it this way. And we don't actually can zoom into the correct position. No, we couldn't. Let's do it that way then. So we have a little one down there, which also is a branding, right? So we can brand it if we like. It only takes a bit of effort creating all the files in the correct size and correct position. But it works, it works. We will come back to how we will, what challenge it is if we go down that road. But I mean, this is something as well that I actually think should be supported, right? Because many companies, if you have a computer in a public place, like, yeah, say hospital again, if you have a computer in a, where you are in the room with it, and it's actually nice to see that it's not the doctor's grandkids on vacation, perhaps, or something even worse, right? So it's actually something, and that should not be an IT decision as well, if you should brand this stuff on, or not. This should actually be something coming from the customer and the end user itself. Because it's the image for their department or their company within your company. So it's actually more, it's actually not an IT discussion, actually. It's an, something you should have with information or branding department or whatever you have. But it is possible. It just takes a while to create all the files. Just because we, it's always nice to show a CMD file, right? So let's see if we can find it here somewhere. So if we look at this one, for instance, it's a good example on how it would look if we want to do everything in one file, right? So it could be done in a VB script instead.
Or PowerShell.
Yeah, I've heard about PowerShell. No, yeah, of course. That's something new, right?
It's been around for a while.
Of course. I actually think I blogged how you do it with PowerShell as well, but yeah. So, built-in applications,
yes.
The good stuff.
Well, I'll steal your machine, it's easier. First of all, for those of you running the default configuration, we've probably seen that every now and then, even in the enterprise edition of Windows 10, additional tiles becomes available, offering exciting new line of business applications like Candy Crush or things like that, that everybody needs, or maybe not. I don't know what bright person that came up with the idea of offering consumer stuff to enterprise editions of Windows, but somebody did. Luckily, there are ways to block this. There is a group policy you can configure. That policy configures that registry value also, obviously. However, when you do that, it doesn't go away completely. The holes where the tiles were supposed to be is still there. It just now not any content in it, but it looks not so nice anymore.
No, it looks broken, basically.
Yeah.
That's a good description.
So we went from having Candy Crush to having a broken experience, so pick one. Luckily, if you do Jürgen's trick with the custom start layout, that fixes that problem. So if you do disable the consumer experience... Are you guys okay? checking. Never know. If you do disable the consumer experience, which I recommend, also combine it with a custom start layout. It doesn't have to be fancy. It could be just some small changes to it, but, you know, it's nice. Second thing is I've seen tons of attempts to using PowerShell things remove built-in apps from Windows. And either you do it when you build your reference image, and then you deploy it, and then you do an upgrade, and then they come back again. Or you're having issues with sysprep or whatever you're having. It's simply, these type of scenarios are not as well tested as other stuff in Windows. But they are supported. You can still go in and remove built-in apps. In my experience, the most reliable way has been so far to do it from the actual image. You know, mount the Vim and get rid of them. But it's also possible at least to do it at deployment time. And there are tons of blog posts of this, not only that one from Nikolai, but also from Michael Niehaus. Microsoft has a PowerShell script that can do this. Ben Hunter, part of the deployment guys blog, they also have a few examples as well. But what happened, Jürgen, if you have a box and you remove some apps, What if an end user is removing something?
Yeah, then it's just removed for that user, right? So it's only for that user, not for everyone on the machine. So yeah. it will be there for the rest of the users for now.
So what if you remove one of the default apps and then you do an in-place upgrade? What will happen?
They will, of course, come back. I'm not sure if you've seen that great experience as well. So if you remove all the built-in apps, or not all of them, because some of them we can't remove as well, except for example. So what we end up doing is we need to use a test sequence to reapply uninstall them again, basically. So that's something we will try to cover as well in a nice table in the end as well. But basically, if we go down this road right now, at least, we are stuck with test sequence for upgrading for the rest of our lives.
Yes.
Hopefully, there's a change coming. There's some blog about saying that something will change in some preview version. Not sure if it really solves the problem right now. We'll see when it's finished. Previews, right?
The thing is, there are other ways of dealing with this instead. Anyone have an idea? Begins with an A. App blocker, thank you. The thing is, this is very well tested and works very well. May not be the nicest experience to the end user, but at least it solves the problem without causing any headaches. It's very easy to configure this. Can I get my screen back?
Sure.
So what you typically do to get this going is that you find a machine, in this case, my PC number 2 client. You open up a local group policy editor. And you navigate your way to where app blocker settings are installed. And I'm just going to start zoom it on this guy as well. So down in the computer security settings, this is where we have the app blocker policies. And here you can see that you also, in addition now in Windows 10, in addition to these guys that has been for a while, and also Windows 7, you have the actual packages or apps, the universal apps in Windows 10. So what I can do here is I can create rules for this as well. So I can add in like the default rules first, allow everything, and then I can go in and say, hey, let's go ahead and create a new rule. And I want to deny everyone from having one of these apps. And when you run it on the client like this, you can actually pick the applications, which you cannot do, of course, if you run it on a server 2012 R2. So if I don't want them to have access to Xbox, whatever, I can simply do an exclusion for that. And I can go ahead and create that rule. Now, this rule is obviously now only here, on this box locally. And by the way, it's not enforced either yet, because application or app blocker also requires you to set an enforcement policy. How should I do this? Should it be okay? Should it not be okay? So, in this case, I have it enforced, but it's not yet configured. So I can do that as well. And say, all right, either just audit, meaning log things in the event viewer, or go ahead and actually block it if I try to launch the Xbox One. So once I've done these changes, once I'm happy, what I simply do is I export this policy. And then I go to my normal server console, management console, and import the same policy. And if you go to Mr. Jurgen's blog post, he has a step-by-step guide on how to go through this and work with this. But AppLocker is a very powerful way, of course, only available in the shiny version of Windows 10 or shinier version of Windows 10, enterprise and education, so you need to have those. But this is a very, very good way of blocking applications and much more reliable than trying to use PowerShell hacks to get rid of stuff that will just be painful for you because they change with every Windows release. And you have to spend engineering time again and troubleshooting time again. Then, of course, we also have, built-in apps, app locker, modern apps, yes. This one.
Yeah. So, OneDrive. You can switch to my machine as well.
OneDrive.
So how many are using OneDrive out there? Some of you, right? OneDrive is a very interesting implementation as well. I actually wrote a blog post on how you actually remove it totally from Windows 10. I removed that line here because that's not really fully supported, because there are some links that are still pointing to OneDrive. But what OneDrive actually does is that when you log on to the machine the first time, the OneDrive agent is actually fully installed in the user's profile. So there's a run once command in the default user hive that actually runs OneDrive setup.exe and installs it in the user hive. So if I look, I don't know if you've seen it, but if we look here, we have the OneDrive folder in the user's profile. And in this one, I only have one version, but this will be adding versions. So the next one will be there as well. And then I will just add folders for each version of OneDrive it has had on the machine in that user profile. So the user profiles will grow, right? And what happens as well is it takes kind of, if you're not using OneDrive, that's why I started removing it, because it takes quite a lot of time, because the first time OneDrive starts, it actually is auto-updates itself. You can control that through group policies, how fast you want that upgrade from its release from Microsoft, but it's downloaded directly from Microsoft and upgraded. So that's one way. So that's what we can do. If we actually want to upgrade this so it isn't downloaded on all my machines, this actual setup file is actually in the Windows. We actually have a file here called OneDrive setup. So that's actually the file that is used when the user logons the first time. So if there's an upgrade being released from Microsoft and you're using OneDrive, that time it takes before it auto-upgrade itself could be annoying for the user the first time they log on. So what you actually can do is just download that OneDrive setup file and just drop it in here with the script during your OS deployment, and then it's the latest version when the users log on, right? Or you can replace it afterwards so that when the end user logs on, it doesn't always have to update the OneDrive stuff over and over again, right? It still takes a minute or two to do it. So that's a good way of doing it well. As well, we can, of course, remove the register key so the OneDrive setup command is never executed, and then you don't have any OneDrive installed at all. So it could be done as well if that's something we choose to do.
Yep.
Otherwise, it updates itself, basically.
Other fun things in this release of Windows 10, 16, or 7 is that, Windows Defender is there. It's been there for a while. But what about this one? What about the Windows Defender kicking in and, hey, what's new in Defender?
Does anyone have anyone seen it? Yeah.
But it's very easy to, configure this, right? It's only that you need, of course, turn it on.
What's that shield icon down there?
It's a symbol for a good feature.
Exactly.
Or possibly that you need to be an admin to do it.
Oh, that's why. I just thought it was nice colors.
So that's the downside. Normal users can't do this. And it still nags them. So it's, not that bright, really.
No, and actually, if you read what it actually does, it actually turns on automatic sample submissions as well. So every file that Windows Defender actually thinks is a virus will be sent to Microsoft for
analysis. Yeah.
And that's also something that some organization don't really
approve.
Or like at all.
Or both. It's not that hard to get rid of. There is a shiny register key that you can flip, and
yeah, if that's present, then it won't show, because then it's already shown it for the user. So it's actually really easy to remove with the group policy preference, for instance.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's really nice.
So that's useful. Forwarding, then.
So, yeah. This is actually not that much about customization in its way itself, but how do you handle your client platform today? How many of you have a monitoring solution in place to monitor that your clients actually are healthy out there? It was a couple of them. So.
Hint, Config Manager won't help you much.
No. Configuration Manager won't help you. Operations Manager, perhaps. But that requires a different license, right? What I always tried to recommend everyone since the last couple of years is actually to use the event viewer and event forwarding, because we get all the stuff in the event log on the machines. We get everything there. But we don't have to. How many of you want to go to the machine, remote control the machine to see what happens? If we do a Windows 10 pilot, how do we know it's successful? The user doesn't complain. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. But then again, you can have like 100 stop errors in the event log with stuff breaking without the end user seeing it. And we have a lot of other solutions as well. Me and Anders Olsson, we presented information protection yesterday with WIP, where we actually can allow the user to change the classification to personal. And we said yesterday that that's logged. Can you guess where it's logged? Of course, in the event log, right? The same goes for if you lose LAPS, the local admin password solution. If a machine can't change the local admin password, where is that information placed? In the event viewer once again. If you use Emmet, the Enhanced Mitigation Experience Toolkit, which you actually shouldn't use on Windows 10, same story there. Everything is logged in the local event log, right? So what I always get to hear when I say that you should use Event Viewer is that, oh, I get so much data so I can't handle it. It's not possible to use it in day-to-day work. Well, that's actually up to you. It depends totally on how you configure it. Say in a big environment, say that it will take you 15 minutes to configure it if you've configured Windows RM before to set this up. Basically, we just start the event. We say that we want to create a subscription. It asks you to say, should I start the event collection service? Yes, please do that. Then I can actually go in here and say, I only want the app locker errors. So I can filter exactly which computers, exactly down to exactly which event log, which description in there. So you don't get all the information, you get exactly what you want, right? So for instance, you use app locker. If an application is blocked for a user by App Locker, they will call Service Desk, right? If you configure this and you set it to minimal latency, which you can do down under Advanced, how long it will take, you will see in the forwarded event logs maximum of 30 seconds after the application is blocked. So you can actually solve it before the end user calls Service Desk if you like. So if we look at my machine here, I have some forwarded events, of course. And here we have an example. App Locker prevented the contact support app from installing, like we presented earlier, that you can block the modern built-in apps to install. So that's how it will look like. I also think if I go down here somewhere, we have some critical errors. I think I have an application that failed as well. So we actually get everything in here. Ask the ones you want. Okay, Event Viewer is really crappy, right? So I've used this PowerShell script. Yes, Johan, it's a PowerShell script, not CMD file last time.
I'm so proud of you.
So what it actually does, it's two scripts. One script that will take everything in the forwarded event log and put it in the SQL database. And then there's a script that you can run like every hour, which only will take the new stuff from the last hour and put it in SQL. And once we have it in SQL, is it easier to access it there? So if I go in, this report wasn't pretty. I tried to solve the resolution before before the session, but I failed actually. I don't know why. But you can actually create your own reports, right? So I can select a specific computer, saying that I want all the forwarded events for this machine. View report, and then I actually get a bad resolution one, but I actually get all the events in here that computer reported. And as I have it in SQL, I can create, I want all computers with this error, I want all computers with an application crash, I want all computers with a blue screen. So you can do whatever you like once it's in SQL. So it takes you like an hour to set up. So if you're not using it today and you're not using anything else, I actually really encourage you to use it. Does it sound like a good idea?
Shiny.
I think so too, actually. So we used it a lot. So that's it's really good. I will do a blog post about it. It feels funny because if you like Bing, event forwarding, you will see that the first blog posts are like, I don't know, 10 years old or something, 15 years old. So it feels kind of funny doing it again, but I will do it because there's a lot of stuff in the documentation that's hard to find.
Can I borrow the screen for a bit?
Sure.
Something that is very tied into this event forwarding, there is another mechanism in Windows that are actually keeping track of the health of the machine. What component is that? Not the event URL, but something else. Reliability history. It's been around since Vista. But this is actually information about the health of the machine since the day you deployed it, where you will see not only, in this case, it's only informational events about installing stuff and updates and whatever, but it will also give you crashes and blue screens and application crashes. It will simply give you a really good overview about the health of this box. This information you can retrieve through PowerShell. I was working with a customer down in Munich. They did some very, very shiny tricks to this. They enumerated every machine they had, put it up in a database on a server, did a web page to see which application that crashed the most, to see what hardware that crashed the most, to see what machines that blue screened the most. And they found that one of their models stood for like 80% of the blue screens in their environment. Kind of nice to have that type of information ready, because then you can actually dispatch some people and say, hey, if we fix this problem, we actually fix 80% of the broken stuff that we have here. So even though this has been around for quite some time,
it's not used enough, not nearly enough.
So good stuff.
Really good stuff.
All right. Forwarding, da-da, lessons learned, check, monitoring.
You can flip back to my machine and we can
do the
wrap up there. Because I've actually one thing more that we didn't have in the agenda I'd like to show you as well.
It's cool.
Has anyone tried to change the Windows search provider? The Edge search provider.
Yes.
For the users, right? I normally use a tool called RegShot. You can use Sysmon if you like. But RegShot is quite nice. Basically, it's a free tool that does a pre-check on the registry. You change what you want and then you get and compare the difference, basically. So this example, I actually changed the search scope. And if we look what the registry key name is, that's actually something that probably I won't try to touch either, right?
Wait.
And the content is crazy as well.
It's a Twitter moment.
So it's actually, the registry key name is actually protected. It's a violation of the Windows policy to modify and a web link to the Windows policy. But have they done this because they have some thought that we shouldn't change it because they want us to use Bing? Well, you could imagine that like was like a world domination plan, right? But it actually more is the fact that malware and web pages shouldn't be able to hijack your search engines. That's one of the main reasons for it as well, because you can't do that. So if you export that whole hive from one machine and import it to the other one, the next one, Edge will actually start up and say, somebody tried to fiddle with your settings, I will reset them. So it's actually to protect you from getting search engine start pages, stuff like that, hijacked by web pages, like we had before. So that's actually why. Then the text file, the text of the registry key itself, that's just a bonus because it's quite funny, right?
Yeah, it is.
So we already touched this subject as well, right? If we go down the road of doing like uninstall the default apps, we do branding of the OS, we do the Internet Explorer link on the start menu, we actually go down the road that we need to do use a test sequence for upgrading in the future as well. Because those modifications will be lost when we do a new feature upgrade.
And also expect that some of these changes that you do may break in between versions because simply, Microsoft doesn't test these customizations well enough, so you will have to do it instead. So you'll take that extra time to verify. Luckily, it's only twice a year now, but you still have to do it.
Yeah, I love the Internet Explorer link on the start menu as well. Do you know why it's lost? It's because the setup engine of Windows 10, it actually searches your whole drive for shortcuts to Internet Explorer and removes them when you do an upgrade.
Yes, you do.
I placed 23 shortcuts to Internet Explorer in 23 different locations, and all of them are lost when you do an upgrade. So I actually called the product group and said, well, why is this happening?
You have too much spare time.
So I actually got a response saying that, yeah, we changed that in Windows Vista. So when you do an upgrade to Windows Vista, you get all your, we remove all the Internet Explorer links, so we have control of them. Yeah, but that's a different topic, right? That was when we did a Vista upgrade, which nobody did anyway, in place at least. Now we are supposed to do this one, two, I don't know how many times in the future, right? And then we remove the Internet Explorer link all the time. So if you add an Internet Explorer shortcut to start menu, taskbar, somewhere, you need to take care of copying that file again, because it will be removed. Basically, wherever you put it, wherever you try to hide it, it will find it.
So, don't get too busy. Try to keep it simple. That's our tip for you. Know that stuff is doable, and certainly is more doable now with 16.07. But the more customizations that you dive into, the more busy you will become for upcoming releases and stuff. Luckily, Microsoft is listening. They do. Not as good as we want them to, but they are listening. And wow.
And we, I mean, customers are learning as well, right? We are learning. We start to adopting the new mindset that we actually shouldn't do this stuff anymore, even if we've done it for 20 years or something. Yeah. So I mean, Microsoft is learning, we are learning, everyone is learning. So maybe it's time to stop. This is actually quite funny in English. Stop curling your end users. It's much better in Swedish, right? Because that's basically what it's about. Maybe it's time to do some investment in end user training, and because you won't be able to put the icons everywhere that the user normally finds them, right? They actually need to learn this stuff themselves. If you can't do that, or if you have fixed workloads machine, of course you can do both, right? But you should actually start investing in end user training, end user manuals, online training, something. Yeah. Because this will save you time and money as well to not do this all the time, every time a new feature update comes, right?
Yep. For more resources, I put some links together on that website to both commercial but also a lot of free stuff, trainings, videos, whatnot, books. You have our blogs, Deployment Research, ccmexec.com. Probably visit them already. Tons of information out there. And by that, we'd like to thank you for spending this final session on Tech Days with us. And have a great week. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.